Well, good morning. I stand down here this morning. Just think it's sometimes we need to just step back from what we're doing and see the greatness of God, the power of God, the holiness of God, and just take some time to meditate and be overwhelmed by our God. And so that's what I want to do this morning, and just walk through some texts with you to help us with this. Whether you're in your reading chair at home, whether you're on your knees in your closet, or whether it's family occasions like this where we can gather together, we just need to do this from time to time and just pause and reflect on how great our God is, how powerful our God is, and how holy our God is. And so if you would open up to Genesis 1, and we're going to just walk through some texts that hopefully help us with some of these things. I want you to think about the way the Scriptures introduce us to God. Before we ever know anything about His character, His name, any background or anything like that, we're introduced to this idea in Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so we're introduced to Him as the creator of all things. And as you go on to read through Genesis 1, you see He said, fill in the blank, and it was so. Over and over and over again, this being spoke everything we see, everything we experience, everything we know into existence, and it happened. And then at the climax of all that in Genesis 1:26, said He made us like Him, in His image, in His likeness. And so again, we're introduced to this powerful creator being who could speak the very world into existence. But then you see He's got some care for us and would lift us up. And again, not a lot said about Him as a good God or a loving God, as a kind God, any of those things. But you do get a glimpse of that in verse 28. Look at Genesis 1:28. We see the first thing that's said about God towards man is God blessed them. God blessed them. So that's a glimpse for us. Some things we'll see as we go on. Open up to Exodus 19, if you would now. Exodus 19. And a lot of history has taken place from Genesis 1 to Exodus 19. And so the children of Israel have just been brought out of Egypt, and they're at the base of Mount Sinai. And this is where they're going to enter into a covenant relationship with God. God's going to give them the law. They're going to say, we'll do this. And they'll enter into this covenant relationship with them. Again, this is really God introducing Himself to them. Now, they've seen, again, some glimpses of God prior to this. I want you to think back about what they've experienced in the recent months, right, with the 10 plagues and the Red Sea. And you think about all the things that happened in Egypt, all the things that happened to the Egyptians. Just think about the Nile turning to blood for a second. You know, some of you, I think, drive across the Wildcat to get here. Imagine that whole Wildcat Creek being like literally blood. I want you to think about that for a second. Or if you came from West Lafayette, you crossed the Wabash. I want you to just think about that river being literally blood. Our God did that. And I want you to think about, you know, the lice or the gnats that were coming up like the dust. You know, that just covered everything, or the locusts that happened later on. I mean, just covered the land. Everything was just black and dark from locusts. Our God did that. And then the darkness that fell on the Egyptians. And this is so cool because inside the Israelites' houses, there was still light. Everything else was darkness. And so while the Egyptians were experiencing darkness for 3 days, the Israelites were filled with light. And then the death of the firstborn. But then they're released, and you think about the way things progressed there with the whole thing with the 10 plagues. Pharaoh kept saying, you know, okay, I'll let them go, but you leave your animals behind. Or, you know, you can go worship here. And he had all these conditions. And before the end of it, God was basically saying, no, we're going to go. We're going to take all our stuff, and we're going to take all your stuff, and we're out of here. And that's exactly what happened. They plundered the Egyptians on their way out, and God led them through. And then you picture the Israelites, and they're traveling. Pharaoh changes his mind and starts chasing them, and Israel comes up to this sea. I mean, I think maybe growing up, I sort of pictured this as like, I don't know, Raccoon Lake or whatever a small little body of water is here. But think about Lake Michigan, right? Some vast body of water where you look out around the horizon and you see water. Where are you going to go? I mean, you are stuck. There's an army coming behind you. You've got a million people. Where are you going to take them? God drew a line in the water and lifted up the water, made walls on either side. The land was dry, and they could just walk across. And then the crazy army chasing them right behind it, God swallowed them up and drowned them in that. And so Israel, again, they've seen some pictures of God, images and experiences that would show him in his judicial power, but also in his power to save and his power to bless. The same things that judged the Egyptians and condemned the Egyptians were his strong right hand to save them. But I want you to think about, that's their experience as they come to Exodus 19, as they're experiencing God. And you read through this, and God tells them a little bit about the covenant they're going to enter in the beginning of chapter 19. And then look at verse 10. God's telling Moses in verse 10, go tell the people to consecrate them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their garments. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. He says, you got to get ready for this, right? You don't just waltz up to God. You spend the next couple days, you getting ready. You wash yourself, you consecrate yourself. You get ready for God to come down to you. And there were boundaries around the mountain, places that they couldn't pass. But pick up in verse 16. This is God introducing himself to the Israelites. Exodus 19, beginning in verse 16. And again, as we read this, try and imagine this and see this in your mind. So it came about on the third day when it was morning that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound. I mean, can you just picture the just power that's happening and thunder and light? I mean, just again, the show that's before them in terms of the senses and the sights and the sounds and all that they would be experiencing. And it says at the end of verse 16, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. I mean, can you see this? I mean, picture this, and just the shaking, and earth is shaking, and there's this thunder sound, and when God or Moses speaks to God, God answers, and it's just this massive booming thunder sound. That's the power of our God as he's manifesting himself to Israel there. And so you think about the reading that Alex read for us a little bit ago, and God had commissioned that this tabernacle would be built so that he could dwell among his people. And you think about the progression of events that happened there. He gave some instructions for sacrifice and instructions for priests. They needed the sacrifice and the priests before God would appear. But then you get to Leviticus 9, and that there's the same kind of imagery again. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and he came down, and you see the fire that came from heaven to consume the offering. The same imagery you see in 1 Kings 8, when the temple itself was built, and Solomon consecrated the temple, and there were the sacrifices. Then it says the glory of the Lord filled the temple in 1 Kings 8, again, came down in this thick cloud. And so again, as God manifests himself to this people, you see these pictures of just this intense power. Everything that we think about in nature as far as intense power, that's how God's showing himself. Go to Isaiah 6, if you would. So those are some examples of God making himself manifest in creation in a historical. I want to look at a couple visions of God and his holiness and his power and his glory. Isaiah 6. This is Isaiah's call to be a prophet. God calls him by introducing himself, and he gets a vision of God before he's commissioned later in this chapter. But let's look at the first four verses. It says, in the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Picture that for just a second. God's on a throne in the temple, and he's got this massive train that's just filling the whole thing. And then in verse 2, seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. Again, do you see this? Think about this in Isaiah's day, right? The king has just died. The king Uzziah has just died. But look at what he sees next. God's on his throne. The earthly king has died, but the true king is reigning, unfazed by what's going on around him. And so you see the picture of his power and majesty and again, royal authority. But you look at these living creatures that would be just incredible in their own right. Seraphim literally means burning ones, fiery ones. And so you've got these just glorious, blazing, on fire creatures that are covering themselves before God's in God's presence, hiding their face and hiding their feet from him, and just keep saying over and over and over again, "Holy, holy, holy." I mean, if we saw one of those seraphim in front of us, we would fall down in terror, yet they're in the presence of our God, and they're saying he's beyond anything. And so showing his holiness, showing his glory, and then look at Isaiah's response in verse 5. When he sees this, he says, "Woe is me. I am ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of hosts." So when he sees God, he realizes, man, I've got nothing. I'm a dead man. I live among all these sinners, and he is so much greater. But then you look at what happens in the next few verses, and this seraphim comes and takes a coal from the altar, touches it to Isaiah's lips, and he's forgiven. And so in this same picture of holiness and glory and power and just otherness that's beyond us, you see just again a picture of God's grace and his mercy and his love and his forgiveness. Open up to Ezekiel 1. Ezekiel's come to Babylon in the second wave of captivity. God's people, just generation after generation after generation, have just repeatedly rebelled against him, lacked faith, and gone their own way. And finally, the cup of wrath is filling up to the tipping point. And so Isaiah's in captivity. And God's glory, as we'll see later in Ezekiel 8 through 10, God's glory is leaving the temple. But as Ezekiel is there in captivity, he's getting this vision of God's glory. And there's a powerful message in that wow, God's here too. Right? You know, we're away from our home, we're away from the temple, but God's here. But again, this is Ezekiel getting a glimpse of God before he's commissioned to prophesy. And we won't read this whole chapter. We'll read parts of it. But look beginning in verse 4. So again, here's Ezekiel, and he's in captivity, and he's down by this river Chebar or canal, whatever you want to call it. In verse 4, he says, "As I looked, behold, a storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud with fire flashing forth continually, and a bright light around it, and in its midst, something like a glowing metal in the midst of the fire." Can you see what Ezekiel's seeing here? As he's just, you know, it's like watching a storm come across the horizon, and this cloud, and there's fire, and there's lightning inside of it. And he sees in the center of it just this glowing, like molten light that's coming out of it. And then he says in verse 5, "Within it were figures resembling four living creatures." And he goes on to describe those living creatures. And this is trippy and strange. And this, there's a lot of strange things in this vision that show, again, these living creatures that have these wings and different faces. But again, lifting up God. And that's the idea, like we saw in Isaiah 6. Look at, go down to verse 13. "In the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, the lightning was flashing from the fire, and the living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning. And so then there's just all this that's taking place, and you know, again, everything that we can think of in our experience that denotes power of nature, lightning and thunder, and that's going on here. But jump on down to verse 26. And again, in this setting, he's describing these living creatures, and he's describing this sort of throne cart, throne chariot. But we finally get to see God in verse 26. It says, "Now above the expanse that was over their heads was something resembling a throne." Okay, it's not a throne. Notice what he says there. Something resembling a throne. And you can just see Ezekiel searching for, how do I picture this? This is just so amazing. How do I picture this? So something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance, and on that which resembled a throne, high up was a figure with the appearance of a man. Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire. There was radiance around him. Stop there for just a second. So again, details that we could just sort of pick out and see a face or anything like that, but there's just this sort of human form that is just glowing. So all above is this molten metal and radiance. And then look at verse 28. And the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on around, I should back up to into verse 27. And from the appearance of his loins downward, I saw something like fire, and there was a radiance around him, as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. So again, can you see this? Just this glowing, molten, powerful being on a throne that's just emanating radiance and brilliant colors and all of this. And I want you to look at what Ezekiel says at the end of verse 28. He says, "Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord." He doesn't say this is God. He doesn't say this is the glory of God or the appearance of the glory of God. It's the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. So if you can get this in your brain and picture this, right? Picture what Ezekiel's seeing. That's a scale reference for us to get just to know, okay, whatever God is, whoever he is, however great he is, it's well beyond this. Okay, so if we can picture this, and this, again, if we saw this, we would die. I mean, we'd fall down. And look at what Ezekiel did at the end of verse 28. He says, "When I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard a voice speaking." And then you see God commissioning Ezekiel in the next section. I mean, that's how you respond when you see something like this, right? And that's what we saw back in Exodus 19. The people were terrified. You see Isaiah and Isaiah 6, again, recognizing God's holiness. And Ezekiel does the same thing. He falls down. Go to Revelation. And, fitting that Logan read for us from Revelation today. I want to go to Revelation 4. I want you to think about this vision that we're going to read in 4 through 5, especially from the perspective of who this is written to, right? This is written to Christians in Asia Minor, and some of them have already experienced some intense persecution. They're about to experience more. It's going to get intense. They're going to suffer for the Lord. They're going to endure an awful lot. But I want you to think about, after the specific letters written to each church, now we've got this series of visions that's meant to lift them up and strengthen them in the Lord and give them what they need to face whatever's ahead. I want you to notice how this starts with a picture of God on his throne. And then let's kind of think through this together. So Revelation 4, beginning in verse 1. "After these things I looked, and behold, a door open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard, like the sound of a trumpet speaking with me, said, 'Come up here, and I'll show you what must take place after these things.' Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was standing in heaven, and one sitting on the throne." That's the first thing he sees. He's going to describe an awful lot going around, but the first thing he sees is the throne and one sitting on the throne. "And he who is sitting on the throne was like a jasper stone and a sardius in appearance, and there was a rainbow around the throne, like an emerald in appearance. Again, notice how he's just grasping for, you know, it's not this, it's like this. So just drawing off of things that we can find, precious stones and rainbows and all these pictures of radiance and glory and brilliance, he's grasping at that to help us picture the radiance and brilliance of our God. Verse 4, and around the throne were 24 thrones, and upon the thrones 24 elders sitting, clothed in white garments and golden crowns on their heads. And these are the Stephanos, which is the victory crowns. Out of the throne came flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder, and seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne, something like a sea of glass, like crystal, and in the center and around the throne, four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. The first creature like a lion, the second creature like a calf, the third creature had a face like that of a man, the fourth creature was like a flying eagle. And the four living creatures, each one of them having six wings, are full of eyes around and within, and day and night they do not cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God, the Almighty, who was, who is to come." I want to just stop there for just a second. Again, the different living creatures we've seen in these different visions vary, but there's one common thread. They're exalting God, overwhelmed by who God is, His holiness, His might, His power, His glory. And so look at verse 9. When the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to Him who sits on the throne, to Him who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders will fall down before Him who sits on the throne and will worship Him who lives forever and ever and will cast their crowns before the throne saying, "Worthy are You, O Lord our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for You created all things, and because of Your will they existed and were created." Can you see this? Okay, there's these assortment of living beings. There's the living creatures, there's the elders, and it's just this like in concert worship where the living creatures are lifting up God and His holiness and His grace, and the elders are falling down because they have victory crowns, but God's the one that's given them the victory, and so they're falling before Him saying, "You're worthy, You're the one that's worthy," and everyone's lifting Him up because He's so gracious and glorious. Go on to chapter 5. He says, and so in the midst of all this, John looks and he sees in the right hand of the one on the throne, said, "I saw in the right hand of Him who sat on the throne a book written inside and on the back, sealed up with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the book and break its seals?' And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the book or look into it. Then I began to weep greatly because no one was found worthy to open the book or look into it." I mean, there's a strong angel, right? Not just an angel who, again, when you look in Revelation later on and John sees an angel on multiple occasions, he falls down and worships because this angel is so glorious, right? So here's a strong angel, but even he's not worthy to open this book and start to accomplish these purposes that's contained in this book that you'll see later in the book, see later in Revelation. But look at verse 5. And one of the elders said to me, "Stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals." You know what he's just overcome? It's what we just shared in. Sin and death. He's overcome, and now he can unleash God's purposes for judgment and salvation. Verse 6, and I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb standing as if slain, having seven horns, seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he came and took the book out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. When he'd taken the book, the four living creatures, the 24 elders, fell down before the lamb, each one holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are prayers of the saints, and they sang a new song. "Worthy are You, O Lord," or excuse me, "Worthy are You to take the book, break the seals, for You were slain. You were purchased for God, Your blood from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. You've made them to be a kingdom and priests to our God, and they will reign upon the earth." Then I looked and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, the living creatures, the elders, and the number of them was myriads of myriads, thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. And every created thing which is on heaven and earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that's in them, I heard them saying, 'To Him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb, blessing and honor and glory and dominion forever and ever. And the four living creatures kept saying, Amen. And the elders fell down and worshiped. I mean, do you see this in your mind? Again, we saw these living creatures lifting up the one on the throne as holy, as almighty. The elders falling down before him, ascribing his worth as the one who gives them victory. And then the Lamb overcomes sin and death, and he is now fit to rule and accomplish God's purposes of judgment. And he takes that book. I mean, think about what a momentous occasion this is when he walks up and he takes the book and starts to accomplish God's eternal purposes. And you see just heaven erupt in worship. The living creatures, the elders, all these just myriads and myriads and millions of angels are just all lifting both of them up as incredible. Our God is amazing. We need to just do stuff like this sometimes. And just, again, whether it's at home in your reading chair, in your closet, or times like this, where we just need to just stop and see our God, see his power, see his greatness, see his holiness, and realize, man, there's just a bigger picture here that we so often miss. And so, do you have that in your mind a little bit? Just that picture of God, the way he's manifested himself in thunder and lightning and smoke and fire and earthquakes and, you know, molten metal and brilliance and rainbow. I mean, if you can get that in your mind, I want you to think about that holy, powerful, great God. And now open up with me to Luke 15. Luke 15. At the beginning of Luke 15, you've got the Pharisees that are criticizing Jesus as a friend of tax collectors and sinners. And Jesus responds by giving a series of parables. Parable of the lost sheep, parable of the lost coin, and then the parable of the lost son or sons. And we're going to see part of that. There's a larger point he's making in context in regards to the self-righteousness of the Pharisees and how much they missed this idea of God's grace. But I want to read just a portion of this parable of the lost sons and make an observation. So look at Luke 15, beginning in verse 11. He said, "A man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me.' So he divided his wealth between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country, and there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now when he'd spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him." Can you believe that guy? I mean, you know, taking his inheritance and just squandering it like that and wasting his life away and you know, going off into just such depths of sin and you know, selfishness and all that. I mean, what nerve, right? But look at verse 17. When he came to his senses or came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread? But I'm dying here with hunger. I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.'" So he's got a plan concocted, right? Okay, this is what I'll do. So he got up and he came to his father in verse 20. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him, felt compassion, and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his slaves, "Quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fattened calf. Kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found." And they began to celebrate. The father in the parable is God. That's, you go through the rest of the parable, that's the point Jesus is making. He's saying our Father in heaven is pictured as this father in the parable. I want to point out a couple things. One, you remember the son's plan? Okay, I'm going to go to my father and confess my sin and my weakness and my shortcoming and admit I am not worthy to be your son and just beg for a spot as a slave. If I could just be a servant, a slave in his house, that would be good enough. Notice the father interrupts him in the middle of his speech, right? He's rehearsed this speech in his head, I'm sure, walking on. Okay, I don't know where. You know, the father interrupts him in the middle of it and says, my son was dead and he's alive. Bring the robe, bring the sandals, kill the calf. Let's celebrate. Go back to verse. I lost it. Oh, verse 20. As he's going to his father, notice when the father goes to him. Do you see that? It says, while he was still a long way off, the father ran to him, had compassion on him, embraced him, and kissed him. The same God who's manifested in thunder and smoke and fire and lightning and rainbow and all this power, immense power, is the same God who runs to us when we're still miles off, way far away. This balance, this picture of God who is just holy and holy in grace that is just beyond us. If we would get that, that would do some stuff to us and change us and impact so much. And just so many times we settle for so much less and get busy about things that don't matter at all and miss this. And we need to realize, man, there's just so much more to God. There's just so much more to life when I can see God and this balance of power and greatness and awe and majesty and grace and love and mercy. And when we put that together, again, that changes us from the inside out. And so the exhortation today is just see God. That this God that we've just looked at, who is so holy and mighty and so gracious, that's a God worth serving. It's a God worth living for. It's a God worth giving everything for and dying for. And so that's the lesson. I want us to just be filled up more and more and more. Let that get inside our hearts, not just frontal lobe, but deep within us, so that we get it. And let that work on us and change us so that we give him what's due. And like those in Revelation, recognize he is worthy and that our lives would reflect that as well. In a moment, we'll sing a song of invitation, and I'll say now, if you're ready to serve God and you want to be baptized into Christ and raise and live a new life, we want to baptize you today. And if you need prayers in any way, we want to pray for you and help you. Before we sing, I want to pray with you, and then we'll stand and sing a song of invitation. Let's go to God in prayer. Our Father in heaven, may your name be hallowed and revered by all. May your name and reputation, may you be held up in the highest place, first by us, and as we show your glory to others, may others come to recognize you as the great Creator and King. May your kingdom be honored and realized and gloried. May your will be done here just as it is in heaven. We know that when you speak in heaven, millions of living beings respond in obedience and praise. And here on earth, so many of us ignore your word and ignore your will. And may that may that change. May each of us obey you from our heart and seek to further your purposes and your will in every aspect of our lives. Help us, Lord, to see your greatness and your power and your holiness, to be overwhelmed by how great you are, and in the midst of this, see you as so gracious that you would run to us in our sin, in our weakness. You're so patient with us when we miss it and just don't get it and live lives that show that we have no clue. You continue to run to us and reach down to us and show us mercy and grace and love. Lord, lift us up and fill us up, but may you be honored above all. Thank you for all you've done in Jesus, his death, his resurrection, the victory that you provide over sin and death, the forgiveness of sins that we have, the adoption that we have, the hope that we have, all because of your great work in Jesus. Help us to see that more and more. May you be honored above all. In Jesus we pray. Amen. You would pull out your songbooks and we'll take this time to sing. If you need anything, please come forward as we stand and sing.